A word of caution. This episode contains depictions of murder and sexual assault that may be disturbing and triggering to some listeners. Please take care when listening.
It's a gorgeous spring morning, and I'm standing on a hill looking at a beautiful home built of stone and wood that overlooks the campus of UNC Asheville in Asheville, North Carolina. You can hear the birds in the background. The trees are blooming. But what a lot of people don't know is that the site where this home sits, the home of the chancellor of UNC Asheville, is where a brutal murder took place on April 15th, 1973. On that Sunday morning, a young student named Virginia Ginger Olson, who was 19 at the time, left her dorm to walk across the street and come and study at one of her favorite spots in the woods. But she never returned to her dorm. Instead, that afternoon, two local high school students who were having a picnic in the park came across her body. She had been stabbed and sexually assaulted. The crime has never been solved. This case has become something I'm interested in because UNC Asheville is where I graduated from college in 1998 with a degree in mass communication. At the time I was a student here, I had no idea there was an unsolved murder that had taken place on this campus. It's been more than 50 years since Ginger Olson was murdered. I think maybe it's time to try to get some answers.
There is much to love about North and South Carolina, but the two states have also had their fair share of violent and senseless crimes over the years. From murders on the Blue Ridge Parkway, in the heart of big cities or sleepy college towns, and along the coastal waters, some of these stories may be new to you. Some may have happened in your town. Some may involve people that are still missing to this day. But all will leave you remembering to always be vigilant about the people you meet and the places you go. I'm Renee Robertson. Please join me for Missing in the Carolinas. Episode 94, Who Murdered Virginia Olson at UNC Asheville? The University of North Carolina at Asheville will always have a special place in my heart because it was at that small college that I came into my own as a journalist from 1994 until I graduated in 1998. For 3 years, I worked on the campus newspaper, the Blue Banner, sharpening my reporting skills, interviewing students and administrators, working late nights at the office with only my jumbled notes and a miniature coffee pot to keep me company. I eventually became the features editor and then the news editor, assigning stories to reporters and perfecting my copy editing and questionable graphic design skills. But I have a confession to make. During that entire time I worked for the campus newspaper and took courses in the mass communication and women's studies departments, I had no idea that the specter of an unsolved murder of a female student from the 1970s loomed over the university. I only discovered this fact in the last few years as I was researching missing persons cases for this podcast. The more I searched, the more I wondered why there had only been a few mentions of this case in the local media since the last news article was published in 1984. Reporters from UNCA's campus newspaper, the Blue Banner, ran articles in 2016 and 2021 about the unsolved murder. They shared details of the murder investigation and a memorial that was built in Virginia Olson's honor in 2013. Another article from the weekly newspaper, the Mountain Express, that discussed cold cases in the Asheville area mentioned the student in 2012. Other than that, it's difficult to find updated information on this case that is now 51 years old. I began going back into the news archives from 1973 to see what I could learn about the murder and the investigation. I will share a full list of sources on the website for this podcast if you're interested in taking a look. Here are the facts of the case as we know them. On the morning of Sunday, April 15, 1973, Virginia Olson, known as Ginger to her friends, woke on a chilly morning in the Craig Dormitory, located on the campus of UNCA, nestled in the mountains of western North Carolina. A sophomore dramatics major, Ginger was known for enjoying her alone time. She liked to read, go on long walks, paint and sketch, and play her guitar. She had grown up in McLean, Virginia, but graduated from high school in Lexington, North Carolina, after her father, C. Doswell Olson, took a new job working as a research technician for the Rural Electrification Administration. She was dating a young man named Jeffrey Doyle, who was a student at the College of William and Mary in Virginia. She'd worked the previous summer as a lifeguard at a swimming pool with a private swim club, where her employer spoke highly of her character. Ginger was looking forward to applying for a summer job at the local playhouse after her classes ended. She wanted to spend the afternoon studying outdoors in the nearby botanical gardens. She put on a green t-shirt, a checkered flannel shirt, blue jeans, and sneakers. She selected her books and said goodbye to her roommate, a young woman named Jane Nicholson. Between noon and 1 p.m., she headed to her destination, stopping to speak with a few fellow students on the path near the dorms that led to the gardens. However, over the years, people studying this case have speculated that the botanical gardens may have been too crowded for Ginger's taste. She headed out of the main area, selecting a quiet spot on a hill in a nearby densely wooded patch of land. Ginger had no idea a predator was lurking in the trees. Around 3:30 p.m., two local high school students, 14-year-old Thomas Guthrie and 17-year-old Larry O'Kelly, were walking through the woods when they came across a horrifying scene. Ginger was lying face up in the middle of the path, and her green t-shirt had been ripped and used to bind her and gag her mouth. She was stabbed in the chest and her neck slashed. Other pieces of her clothing were scattered around the area. Her personal journal sat nearby, with her wire-rimmed glasses placed upon it. The Friday before the murder, Ginger's parents had come through town on their way to visit family in Dudley, Missouri. They stopped and had a visit with their daughter and then continued on. They received a call on Sunday that Ginger had been murdered. When her friends from Lexington learned of the murder, they were shocked. One told a reporter with the Greensboro Daily News that Ginger was the sort of person who trusted everyone, but if she found out she was wrong, she wouldn't hate them. A 19-year-old young man visiting the area from Richmond, Virginia, was arrested the day after the murder for breaking into the Greek Hellenic Community Center. He was questioned about Ginger's death, but was later released after police verified his alibi. Very early on, police questioned a man they felt was a strong suspect in Ginger's murder. According to reporting by the Asheville Citizen-Times, he was a 45-year-old white male who rented an apartment within walking distance of the crime scene. On the day of the murder, he met up with a friend who drove him around North Asheville, including the botanical gardens. The suspect pointed out a young woman who was sitting on an embankment overlooking the garden. The time frame for this occurrence would have been around 1 p.m. Police believed this must have been Ginger. The suspect's friend then dropped him back near his apartment on Merriman Avenue, near Hillside Street. A female neighbor told police the suspect came to her apartment around 2:40 p.m. that day. He was nervous and wanted someone to pray with him. He went to another neighboring apartment and complained to the resident that something was a bloody mess. A few years after the murder, police interviewed a new witness about something she had seen on the afternoon of April 15, 1973. She was walking her dog in the botanical gardens when she saw a man walk out of the woods, run down the embankment, cross W.T. Weaver Boulevard, and walk up a grassy hill leading to UNCA's campus. The embankment was where Ginger's body was found. This was between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m. She described him as being a big person, though not particularly tall, and stated he was wearing brightly colored clothing. She thought he was around 25 years old. Other witnesses reported seeing a man walking up the embankment where Ginger was murdered, and they said he was sitting with a young woman up there at one point. A man who was parked near the gardens that afternoon so he could listen to an auto race on his car radio said he saw a man walk up to the area where Ginger had been found slain. He described this man as 23 to 24 years old, wearing dark paratrooper-style boots and standing about 5 feet 10 inches tall and weighing around 165 pounds. Both this witness and the woman walking her dog said he appeared to have something on his back, like a small backpack or a sweater tied around his neck. The woman who prayed with the suspect at the apartments said he had a sweater tied around his neck and was wearing brightly colored clothing and dark boots. While the suspect was 45 years old, the witnesses described him as being younger. The police said the man looked younger from a distance, which may have confused the witnesses when estimating his age. After his distressing behavior at the apartment complex, the suspect then drove to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and checked into a motel there on April 17th, 2 days after the murder. He stayed there until April 28th, when he returned to Asheville. Police questioned him the next day upon his return and searched his apartment. They took a pair of brown dingo boots, a white t-shirt, a yellow velour shirt, a kitchen knife, and a white handkerchief. These items were sent to the State Bureau of Investigation Crime Lab in Raleigh for analysis, but the police said the results of the tests came back negative. I'm not sure what they tested negative for, but I'm assuming it was blood. This suspect was not a native of Asheville. In fact, police learned he was under the care of a psychiatrist in Asheville at the time of the murder, and there are rumors that the suspect was in outpatient treatment at nearby Highland Hospital. This psychiatrist declined to speak to the police about the suspect, citing doctor-patient confidentiality, and then he passed away within a few years. I want to take a minute and talk about Highland Hospital, where the main suspect in this case was allegedly receiving treatment. Highland Hospital has a long and storied history in the town of Asheville. A physician named Dr. Robert S. Carroll founded the facility in 1904, and it was known then as Dr. Carroll's Sanitarium. It was touted as offering superior accommodations for the limited number of nervous, chronic, and drug habit cases. A few years later, the facility relocated from its location on Haywood Street in downtown Asheville to Zillicoa Street. It sat on 38 acres, and eventually two more buildings were added. In 1912, it was renamed Highland Hospital. It advertised itself as having amenities that could be found in a hospital, sanitarium, and home, including steam-heated rooms and open fireplaces. It had a swimming pool and offered massage and electric treatments. The Asheville Citizen Times reported that physical activity was a large part of the hospital's program. Here's a direct passage from the article. In addition to music, reading, and parlor games, tennis, and other outdoor sports for which there is ample room, drives unsurpassed in beauty and variety, horseback riding over perfect roads and through scenes of unrivaled diversity, with climbs which invigorate, strengthen, and inspire, are provided for the patients. Trips to surrounding points of interest are arranged from time to time. Tramps along trout streams, hunting excursions in the mountains, camping parties, climbing expeditions, anything that will bring back the bloom of health again to the cheek and the old vigor to the weakened constitution. There were additional guidelines imposed on the female patients during the early years of the hospital. Dr. Carroll forbade the use of mirrors, as he felt that primping in front of them, as well as using rouge and lipstick, were false modes of concentration on the self. Incidentally, George Vanderbilt felt the same way about Asheville and designed his family's mansion, the Biltmore Estate, with the dream of hosting friends and family in the cool mountain area where they could swim, hike, ride horses, and enjoy the outdoors. Many physicians at the time believed this type of natural treatment could cure a number of ailments. Construction on that estate began in 1889. During this time period, another doctor also opened a sanitarium designed for the treatment of tuberculosis in the Kenilworth area of Asheville. But back to Highland Hospital. In 1939, Dr. Carroll donated the facility to Duke University, but he remained the medical director there until his retirement of January 1945. A frequent patient at Highland Hospital was Zelda Fitzgerald, the wife of author F. Scott Fitzgerald. In 1948, an electric coffee urn in the hospital's central building started a fire. Investigators believe the fire spread through the kitchen and up a dumbwaiter to all four floors. The facility had fire escapes, but many of the screened porches and windows were shackled with chains to keep patients from jumping out. There was no sprinkler system. 9 patients, including Zelda Fitzgerald, died in the fire. 11 patients were rescued. That building on the property was never rebuilt, and today there is a granite memorial that contains the following quote from a letter Zelda wrote to Scott. "I don't need anything except hope, which I can't find by looking backwards or forwards, so I suppose the thing to do is shut my eyes." Psychiatric Institutes of America purchased Highland Hospital in 1981, and it closed in October of 1993. Before we continue, let's take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Are you looking to level up your writing or learn a new skill? Whether you focus on nonfiction or are more inclined to creative writing, or want to learn how to put together a digital portfolio of your writing, WOW Women on Writing can help. Interested in podcasting? Check out a digital course I created called You Can Start a Podcast. During this pre-recorded webinar, you will learn the benefits of creating your own podcast, materials you need to get started, how to develop content that will keep listeners coming back for more, and ways your podcast can create supplemental income. I'll share examples of different types of podcasts, how to decide on a format, ways to handle the technology necessary for creating a podcast, how to develop your first few episodes, promotion and monetization ideas, and ways you can repurpose your podcast content. All written materials and resources are provided by me. I'll also give you a handout with information discussed in the webinar, along with suggestions for a few different types of podcasts to explore. Best of all, this webinar only costs $30. You can find it by going to wow-womenonwriting.com and clicking on the Classroom tab. I'll also post a link in the show notes. Here's your friendly PSA that if you haven't been using the skincare products from SkinX Erin, you're probably doing it wrong. But it's never too late to do the right thing. The pre-cleanse oil is the best way, in my opinion, to thoroughly melt away excess makeup, sunscreen, environmental pollutants, and residual product buildup from your skin without stripping. I use their pre-cleanse oil every morning and night, followed by my daily cleanser for fresh skin. And here's another tip for the upcoming summer season. Before you go out in the sun, apply the hydrating beauty oil because it helps rehydrate the skin, reduces inflammation, and repairs the skin barrier. After spending the day in the sun, the Perfecting Night Oil accelerates healing, prevents peeling, and can quickly help a burn turn into a tan overnight. Try it. Go ahead and treat yourself with 10% off your order using my code MissingCarolinas10. I'll include a link in the show notes for you. And now, let's get back to the show. An associate of the primary suspect's father, who was the head of a prominent law firm up north, arranged to have him flown out of Asheville shortly after the police questioned him. At the time the 1976 article was published, his last known address was a mental hospital near Boston, Massachusetts. There were two other persons of interest in the area of the Botanical Gardens that day. A witness from Hendersonville, who was visiting the area with his wife and another couple, said he saw a young woman sitting with a man on top of the embankment. But he described the man as wearing a green army fatigue jacket, and this was different than the man with a sweater tied around his neck and wearing beige slacks. This group also said they saw another white male walking past the gardens toward the university campus around 2:30 p.m. as they were on their way out. This man was described as rather tall and thin, wild-eyed, and in his early 20s. Police knew who this wild-eyed suspect was. They said he was employed as a gardener by the university and had a history of emotional and mental problems. They told the Asheville Citizen-Times reporter that another suspect, a Marine, had been staying at a motel on Merriman Avenue. This man could have also fit the military dress description, and they pointed out that it was not unusual at that time for men in their 20s to be dressed in army boots or fatigue jackets. I have to wonder if the witnesses saw two or three different men in the area of the Botanical Gardens on the afternoon that Ginger was murdered, and that would explain the conflicting descriptions. Exactly 1 year after Ginger Olsen's murder, another female UNCA student went missing. An 18-year-old freshman from Buffalo, New York, was living with an aunt in the Skyland area and commuting to the university. She failed to return home as usual on Friday evening and was reported missing on Saturday. Her parents had arrived in town to pick her up for an Easter trip to Florida. Police began searching the campus, including the secluded spot near the gardens where Ginger was murdered. On Monday, the student, who I'm going to call Kay, showed up near a construction site near the Asheville Civic Center downtown and begged for help. Once she was taken to the local hospital, she gave her statement to the police. Kay said she had received a ride on Friday afternoon from a classmate to the downtown Pritchard Park area. She was then approached by a young woman near the Woolworth's department store and recruited to be interviewed for a magazine article. She was taken to an apartment where the woman pulled a knife. While there, Kay was sexually assaulted by a male accomplice. On Monday, she managed to escape by stabbing the female captor in the hand with a fork. 17-year-old Louise Bray and 19-year-old Walter Smith, who lived on Cherry Street, were charged with rape and kidnapping in the incident that police deemed an unusual coincidence in the anniversary to the Olson murder. On September 6, 1974, the Asheville Citizen-Times reported that a member of the Asheville Police Department and the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation had been dispatched to make arrangements to question a man being held in northern Florida for a series of rapes. They discovered this man had been a student at UNCA in 1969 and was living in the vicinity of the campus when he served time in Buncombe County for some burglaries. This suspect was eventually ruled out. In 1984, the Asheville Citizen-Times reported that members of the Asheville Police Department were heading to Santa Fe, New Mexico, to speak with a man who was questioned and released 2 weeks after Ginger Olson's murder. I believe this suspect was the man dressed in brightly colored clothing residing in the apartment near campus, the one who asked his neighbor to pray with him. This article said the man was the prime suspect in the murder. The article went on to say that in 1983, Captain Will Anarino mentioned laser identification of fingerprints and new subtypes of blood that can be distinguished, and recent Supreme Court rulings that would allow the subpoena of evidence banned 11 years ago. He also said the SBI had reanalyzed Olson's blood-smeared jeans found at the crime scene. Captain Anarino gave more information about the suspect, saying he was a highly educated former Army officer from an upper-middle-class family. He had been treated in mental institutions. His only prior record at the time was a voyeurism charge in San Francisco, several years before Ginger Olson was murdered. After this 1984 article, I was unable to find anything else about this case until the campus newspaper, the Blue Banner, published articles about it in 2017 and 2021. If I had to guess, I'd say this main suspect in New Mexico promptly got an attorney and refused to cooperate with the police. The campus environment at UNCA was very different in 1973. I graduated from the university in 1998, when there was a relaxed and laid-back vibe, and many of my friends were trying to get tickets to see artists like the Ben Folds Five or A Tribe Called Quest, or attend the Lilith Fair Music Festival. The school did have a lot of commuter students, and that was the same in 1973. There were only about 200 students attending the school, and most of the professors then were male. Unfortunately, Ginger Olson died around the same time that the Watergate scandal broke out, so that story overshadowed any headlines Olson's murder may have received. I belong to a Facebook group called You Know You're From Asheville If, and it's a great place to find stories and photos of Asheville from the past. I posted that I was working on an episode about the murder a few months ago. It stirred up old memories for a few people that posted comments and sent me messages. One person remembered the son of a prominent Asheville family being interviewed after the murder. Another said she was a high school senior when the crime happened and worked at the UNCA cafeteria on the weekends. She was working on that Sunday and had taken a walk in the gardens between the lunch and dinner shift. She didn't see anything on her walk, but heard about the murder later. She never walked alone on campus on her breaks ever again. Another man said he worked at Highland Hospital at the time and was briefly questioned by the police when he walked by the area where the body was found. And yet another woman said she knew people who worked as orderlies at Highland Hospital during that time period, and there were also patients that were allowed to attend classes at the college. This person estimated about 75% of the students were commuters, and there were a lot of Vietnam veterans there using their GI bills. The campus was very open, and there was not a lot of security. I recently met with Detective Kevin Taylor, who retired from the Asheville Police Department in 2015 after 28 years of service. He is very familiar with the Ginger Olson case and is still working for the APD's cold case unit part-time. He shared that the case remains active and open, and they are seeking tips that could help close it. I did inquire about the suspect who detectives tried to re-interview in 1984. He said he believed the man had arrests in New Mexico for some Peeping Tom charges and that he died about 10 years ago. He doesn't believe he was ever arrested for a violent crime. Detective Taylor also confirmed that physical evidence from the crime scene still exists, but he didn't specify in what form. He mentioned that the weekend of the murder, there had been a concert on campus, in case anyone attending that remembers anything worth mentioning to the police. The bands included were Grassroots, Sugar Creek, and Morrison and Swan Plus. The Asheville Police Department has an app you can download through the iTunes App Store or Google Play. You can search Asheville PD, all one word, for this app, and that has a feature that will allow you to submit a tip anonymously. If you don't have a smartphone, you can share information with the police by sending an anonymous text to tip2APD and then messaging 847-411. As luck would have it, as I was finishing up the script for this episode, I was contacted by another UNCA alumnus who is now a college professor. He's done extensive research on this case, especially as it relates to the history of the university, and he's agreed to do an interview for a future episode of Missing in the Carolinas. He mentioned something to me I hadn't thought of before. In episode 26, Missing Moms in North Carolina, I mentioned a convicted serial killer from Asheville named Terry Hyatt. He was convicted of murdering Harriet Delaney Simmons from Raleigh in April of 1979, Betty Sue McConnell from Asheville in August 1979, and he was later tied to the murder of Jerry Ann Jones in Charlotte. In each of these murders, he raped and stabbed his victims to death. I didn't realize it, but he was probably still living in Asheville when Ginger Olson was murdered. He would have been young, maybe 16 years old, but I wish I had asked Detective Taylor if Hyatt had ever been considered a suspect. He is currently on death row. Students from the 1970s would hardly recognize the campus now. Many of the old dormitories, including the one Ginger lived in, have been torn down and replaced with new, more luxurious accommodations. In 2013, a former UNCA student who attended the school from 71 to 73, Richard Beard, helped create a memorial garden for Ginger, including three handcrafted benches featuring plaques between Owen and Whiteside's halls. He felt the university should create a space to honor the young student who senselessly lost her life while studying one spring afternoon. The very spot where Ginger was murdered is now home to the UNCA Chancellor's residence, the Pisgah House. It's a multi-million dollar home constructed of polished wood and stained glass, surrounded by serene manicured gardens. Ginger wrote the following heartfelt words when she was a student happily looking forward to a bright future. "Just for today, I will be unafraid. Especially, I will not be afraid to be happy, to enjoy what is beautiful to love, to believe those I love, love me." Virginia Marie Olson. I personally love Western North Carolina and go back to visit it every chance I get. But the mountains can be mysterious, and over the years, dangerous people have lurked in the shadows. Many young women, such as the one I was back in the 1990s, have trusted a false sense of security in the outdoors when they probably shouldn't have. A few years before Ginger was murdered, in 1970, 24-year-old Nancy Morgan was brutally murdered while working as a government volunteer in the hills of Madison County. Karen Stiles was murdered in 1994, during my freshman year of college, when she went out to run on the trails in the Pisgah National Forest. It was an area she felt safe in, where she put many miles in, until the day she crossed paths with 26-year-old Richard Allen Jackson. I've had the idea for this podcast episode for at least 2 years. There isn't a lot of new information in the media about this case, especially recently. I envisioned creating a separate series, but I kept hitting roadblocks in my research. I had people I wanted to interview, including surviving members of Ginger's family. A letter I sent to her surviving sister several months ago was just returned back to me in the last 2 weeks. I must have sent it to an address that's no longer in use. With the anniversary of Ginger's death fast approaching, I decided to go ahead and release this episode. But hopefully, this is just a start. I pray that anyone out there who hears this and has a tangible lead will contact the Asheville Police Department. And I invite anyone who knew Ginger, attended UNCA at the time of the murder, or has additional information to reach out to me at missinginthecarolinas@gmail.com. I'd love to talk to you and possibly schedule an interview. This brings us to the conclusion of this week's episode of Missing in the Carolinas. If you enjoyed this episode, please do me a favor and give it a 5-star rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're also now on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, so please like our pages and get started on a discussion of the missing people profiled on the show. Do you know of a missing persons case in North or South Carolina that you think should be covered? Email me at missinginthecarolinas@gmail.com with any details you can share. And don't forget to check out our sponsor, WOW Women on Writing, and the great programs and writing contests they have to support writers at wow-womenonwriting.com. Treat yourself to a skincare kit from SkinX Erin with my code MissingCarolinas10. Cover art for this podcast was designed by Macintosh Multimedia. Sound editing is provided by Daniel Robertson. Thanks so much for listening.